Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, June 1st, 2018. Your humble host has been railing about the dangers to our privacy presented by an FBI-developed monitoring system called Stingray. And now we have credible reports from the government confirmed by private security experts that the White House is targeted by Stingray-like devices. Now, I want to toot my own horn a little bit here, because it was a podcast with Bo Hodai, the independent investigative journalist several years ago, who first brought our attention to these sneaky systems. They were developed by the FBI and then quietly rolled out to local and regional law enforcement agencies. And these devices, which go by different names, but the Kleenex equivalent, if you will, of the brand name is Stingray. And Stingray is made by the Harris Corporation, which also makes radio transmitters and other electronic systems. Stingray, it simulates a cell phone tower. And it requires all cell phones within a certain radius to check in with the fake tower, the same way your phone checks in with a real tower, depending on your current location. And the Stingray system captures the location of your phone, the number, the serial number of your phone, and some advanced, more sophisticated versions of Stingray and the Dirtbox, we're told, are capable of accessing your contacts, reading your emails, and listening to voicemails and to real-time telephone calls. It is a major intrusion into our Fourth Amendment rights. It is dragnet surveillance. And because of media coverage, some police agencies now get a warrant before they use a Stingray. But we don't believe all of them do. And the corporate media has largely failed to highlight these intrusive systems. So now, according to Senator Ron Wyden, and we cited earlier this week a letter that he published from the Department of Homeland Security talking about the cellular network vulnerabilities of SS7. Now, what we're told is that SS7 tells the next cell tower that your phone's going to connect to, hey, here comes Peter B., and he's in the middle of a conversation with one of his secret girlfriends. And that information is not well secured. And this is a vulnerability that we're told may allow bad actors to access and monitor our telecommunications. So, in the same letter, we're now learning that Ron Wyden was alerted by the Department of Homeland Security. They confirmed his concerns that the White House and other public facilities in Washington, D.C. have been targeted by these devices. Now, there is no speculation whatsoever on whose Stingrays these are. Now, your first inclination might be to think that it's an American agency or an American actor. Could be. But it also could be Israeli intelligence, British intelligence, Chinese, or yes, even Russian surveillance activities. And because Trump has been publicly defiant about the security requirements that they tried to impose on him, and he's continued to use a minimally or unsecured cell phone for his Twitter activities, this is of grave concern. And does Trump use a landline that is secured when he makes his nightly phone calls to chit-chat with Sean Hannity, or does he just pick up his cell phone? These are questions, but the vulnerability is pretty clear. Now, a company called ESD America has several corporate and foreign government clients, and they have assisted in the detection of these potential Stingray operations, the nomenclature is IMSI Catcher, across many cities, including Washington, D.C. And in Washington, ESD said it had detected signs of stingrays near the White House, the FBI, the Senate, the Pentagon, the Russian embassy, and along the Embassy Row in Northwest Washington, which is also where the vice president's residence is. Now, I'm one of these people who's been talking, maybe ad nauseum, you think, about this breach of our Fourth Amendment privacy and security rights. But this deserves a deep investigation. And certainly, we deserve to know exactly who has been trying to snoop on communications in Washington, D.C. And we'll see if this becomes a bigger story. But if past is any predictor, the corporate media will snooze through it. So our reality TV star guy who's posing as president tried to pull off a kind of cliffhanger. Being Mr. Hard to Get, he had canceled the summit with Kim Jong-un scheduled for June 12th in Singapore. And now, after a meeting with the top North Korean diplomat, Kim Jong-chol, Trump has announced that the summit is uncanceled, and he is planning to meet with Kim Jong-un on June 12th in Singapore. And what remains to be ironed out is really the schedule of when North Korea will take steps to, it says, denuclearize, and along the way at what point Trump would agree to ease the sanctions on North Korea. And it appears that Trump's comments show that, well, this is going to be a process, it might take more than one meeting. So he's trying to downplay the expectations of his 50 million Twitter followers that he's going to go in and just breeze through the art of the deal and come away with a peace treaty from the 70-year-old Korean War and everything else falling into place. I don't think it's going to be that simple, and I have grave reservations about Trump representing us. Now, we're told he's going to Camp David this weekend without Melania, and he's going to study up on nuclear weapons, North Korea, and other issues related to the meeting in June. But again, if past is any predictor, they'll show him some videos, and he'll get distracted and start tweeting about Hillary Clinton, and who knows where that will go. And speaking of the president's Twitter fingers, they got a little itchy this morning, and he violated longstanding protocols about not tipping the information in the employment report from the Labor Department for at least an hour after the numbers are revealed. And this is to try to prevent any kind of influence of the stock market. But Trump, in a premature Twitter ejaculation, made comments about how he's expecting good numbers. And the numbers did come in. They're pretty positive. 223 jobs were added last month against a projection of about 190,000. It brings the unemployment rate down to 3.8%, and Trump has stopped talking about the people who are locked out of the labor market because he's not campaigning anymore and he likes positive numbers. And earnings are creeping up, but very slowly, just at the rate of 8 cents per hour. Now, Trump did get a bump. The stock market was up a couple of hundred points. But I believe that the trade war that he has launched is going to lead to layoffs and potential declines in employment in the very near future. We're already seeing angry comments coming from Europe over the announcement yesterday that within 12 hours we would impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imported to the United States. And keep in mind that all of these tariffs that Trump is talking about violate the agreements of the World Trade Organization that the U.S. is signatory to. But Trump is pretending that due to national security concerns, he has to exercise his authority to impose these tariffs. This puts Europe in a tough spot, because they want to file complaints, actions with the WTO, accusing the U.S. of going rogue. But by doing so, it requires them to honor the terms of the WTO agreement, which means that while they can threaten to counter us with tariffs on goods imported from Europe, they may not be able to follow through if they want to succeed in a complaint before the tribunals at the WTO. The bottom line is that Trump may get some concessions, and he may lift these tariffs in short order, and in that case, it would go away. But if not, we're going to have a lot of angry Europeans, and they're going to put taxes on bourbon and Levi's and anything else that they can figure to retaliate against these unilateral and arbitrary moves by the Trump administration. And if you know the situation with the stock market, we have lost all of the gains that occurred between January and when Trump started roiling the markets about 6 weeks ago. So the stock market is flat overall in its performance for 2018. And the uncertainty created by the trade wars can't help the progress of the market over the next few months. This also has led to, in some ways, changes in European leadership. In Spain, the Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, was forced to step down today, and he's being replaced by Pedro Sanchez, the leader of the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, following a no-confidence vote. This means Spain is moving away from austerity. It's moving away from right-wing conservative government. Sanchez has made conciliatory comments about the Barcelona independence movement, the Catalan independence effort. So this could be a very positive change from my perspective in Spain. But just across the Mediterranean there, in Italy, a new government has been formed after it looked like that wasn't going to happen. And the anti-establishment, populist, anti-immigrant, five-star movement is forming a government with the right-wing party called League. And they have announced their cabinet members, shuffled them a little bit to form this government. And the leader of five-star, Salvini is the leader of League. He has pledged to expel hundreds of thousands of migrants, and he's been named the interior minister. So it could get very Trumpian in Italy, even without the return of Silvio Berlusconi. Meanwhile, Bashar al-Assad told that dangerous international media network, RT, the one that corrupts so many Americans, that it's time for the United States to get the hell out of Syria. Now, Obama had inserted a couple of thousand troops. It might be as many as 3,000. They are mostly hunkered down with Syrian Kurds in the area near the Euphrates River, alongside the border with Iraq. And Bashar has said he wants the Americans to leave. Somehow they are going to leave. And he has regained control of virtually all of the rest of his country. And what is the basis for U.S. troops in Syria? They were there to vanquish the Islamic State, which has largely occurred. And we don't have a mission, and Trump has said that he wants to get out, but it appears the Pentagon is slow walking that effort by Trump. It's one of the few things I agree with him on. We'll see where it goes. The European Court of Human Rights has censured Lithuania and Romania for their complicity in the CIA's secret rendition and torture program, which included black sites, one in Bucharest, Romania, and another in Lithuania. And we know that Abu Zubaydah and the guy named al-Nashiri were at the center of a hearing before the same court in Strasbourg, Germany. The court has ordered Lithuania to pay Abu Zubaydah $152,000 in damages, and it's ordered Romania to pay $117,000 to al-Nashiri. When will the United States be held accountable? The people we forced to collaborate with us on this barbaric mission have been penalized. But not the United States, which devised and ran that program. And I don't expect to see it in my lifetime. Meanwhile, in Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega and his wife, the vice president, whose name is Rosario Murillo, they are facing more protests, and another 15 protesters were killed during a march that was nominally called Mother's Day to honor the mothers of those who have been killed in protests over the last couple of months. This all started when the government made changes to the Social Security system, raising worker contributions while cutting retirees' pensions, and the student groups that had been reliable supporters of Ortega turned on the president, and he is now clinging to power by brutalizing many of his former supporters. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Judy Holloway, Steve Wozenski, Benny Alto, and Carla Mahoney. I really appreciate your support, and if you are not a supporter, I'd like you to change that. Now, I want you to be solvent. I don't want to be taking your rent money or your Social Security check. But if you've got an extra $5 to send my way each month, I'd really appreciate it. Just visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You jump to the sign-up page, and in a minute or two, you can be all good to go. And if you'd rather communicate using the U.S. mail and avoid PayPal, I understand. My mailing address is Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And today, I'm releasing to my subscribers a fresh, in-depth interview. Yeah, I haven't posted an interview in a couple of weeks because of travel and vacation. But this is a powerful one that could change your perception of American history. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the political prisoner still incarcerated in Pennsylvania, collaborated with his co-author Stephen Vittoria for Volume 1 of a three-part series called Murder Incorporated. It's an alternative history of the United States focusing on empire, genocide, exceptionalism, manifest destiny, and it is irreverent. It is citing people who don't make it into the mainstream narrative of American history textbooks. And I hope you will listen, and I hope you will pick up the book as well. Here's an excerpt from the podcast in the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You know, when we speak of key defects of U.S. history, we must be mindful of the fact that all countries have founding myths drawn to inculcate the young into adoration of the nation, which really shows us why school kids get so much bunk in history class, and why most Americans grow up with such myths and still hold them as sacred. We've got to remember that different populations in the U.S. have quite different histories from other parts of the country. Consider this. Isn't it simply logical that blacks, Indians, and WASP whites have profoundly different understandings of history? They each experienced America differently, right? When Americans went abroad, they would point to the Constitution to show foreigners how just the nation was when it came to black people. They could point to the so-called Reconstruction Amendments to show that black folks had constitutional rights. In fact, after Reconstruction, those rights written in the Constitution were eliminated by state laws which supported white supremacy and disenfranchised blacks from voting, from jury service, and a whole lot more. So history, true history, shows us what's underneath the promises, you dig? Also, we try to address and engage all of the communities and histories from an anti-imperialist perspective. So Murder, Inc. seeks to tell the stories of regular people who made historical contributions to making and remaking America. Those excluded millions who did the work of rebellion, resistance, and revolution.
You can hear the full interview with Mumia and Stephen Vitoria. It's available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker. And I hope you will find it and grab it and listen to it. Feel free to send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com. Earlier this week, we talked about the controversy at Google, where at least 4,000 employees have signed on to a petition saying, "Don't be evil and get us out of the Maven program," a Pentagon contract with Google. They say it's only $9 million, but it is to use artificial intelligence to sharpen the targeting of American drones. And today, the CEO of Google Cloud, Diane Greene, told employees that they will not follow through on Maven. Now, they're not canceling the contract, but they are saying when it ends March of 2019 next year, they will not renew it. That's kind of half a loaf. But leaked emails published by Li Feng at The Intercept today show that Google expected to get much more than $9 million over time. They were competing with Amazon, whose cloud division has a huge, I think, $600 million contract with the CIA. And their decision to bail on Project Maven means that they will not benefit from what was projected as a $250 million annual contract. And this all comes from emails that Li Feng acquired. He is a very resourceful reporter. And I will link in the show file to this podcast to his article so that you can get the details yourselves. Also in Silicon Valley, Mark Zuckerberg had his annual meeting with shareholders, and he took a lot of heat. There are angry people who consider him to be a dictator, and they want to try to force Zuckerberg out. But if you know anything about the voting rights of shareholders of Facebook, it will never happen. Because Zuckerberg structured his company just the way the founders of Google did, so that he has control over the shares that have voting rights, and people who own shares in Facebook have little or no voting power to take on the founders. And Facebook is also trying to diversify its board of directors. There is one African-American serving there now, and they're going to put a second on the board. Also, Facebook has announced that it is phasing out the trending section. They launched it back in 2014 to help us quickly find interesting topics. But the head of news products said that users are shifting to consuming news on their phones and through video, and so that function will be discontinued. Over at Consortium News today, my old friend Marjorie Cohn, the professor of constitutional law emeritus at the Thomas Jefferson School in San Diego, opens up a really important issue. Barack Obama had weekly video conferences. They were held mostly on Tuesdays, where they would present him with options of people to order killed by a drone strike. And it created the kill list. Obama personally supervised it. We don't know how Trump handles that. There have been fewer drone strikes under Trump than there were under Obama, but drones are still an active part of our military arsenal. And there are two people, one a U.S. citizen, the other a citizen of Syria and Pakistan. They are both journalists. The Pakistani works for Al Jazeera, and they are both on America's kill list today. The American has survived five attempts on his life from targeted airstrikes. His name is Bilal Abdul Karim. And the Syrian-Pakistani guy, Ahmad Muafak Zaidan, senior journalist at Al Jazeera, he learned about his inclusion on the kill list from Ed Snowden's leaks. And both of them are trying to get off that list before it kills them. They've gone to court in front of the District of Columbia Judge Rosemary Collier. Now, Collier is the judge who heard the case from Anwar al-Awlaki's father. Awlaki was an American citizen killed by a U.S. drone in Yemen. It was a summary execution without due process as required by the Fifth Amendment for an American citizen. And it was rationalized by Obama, and in the book that we reported on here that was written by Scott Shane about the killing of Alaki. And as you may know, his father, Nasser al-Awlaki, went into federal court and said, look, you're going to try to kill my son, and that violates the Fifth Amendment. Ultimately, the courts dismissed him for lack of standing, saying that bring Anwar in here and he can plead his case, but you are not permitted to do that. But it appears that Collier views these journalists differently. She says, I'm very concerned about the rights of a U.S. citizen who asserts that he is not a combatant, that he has not taken sides, he is just a journalist doing his job. I commend Professor Cohn for bringing this story public, and I hope we'll see some action on it. The strictest abortion law that's been passed today by the anti-abortion activists in the United States comes out of Iowa, and it bans women from getting abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy based on the presence of a fetal heartbeat. This is clearly unconstitutional based on Roe versus Wade. And earlier this week, we reported that the Supreme Court declined to take up the appeal from Arkansas about its pretextual abortion law, which is shutting down clinics and preventing women from using drugs to conduct an abortion, a so-called medical abortion. And so the people who passed this in Iowa are looking for a fight. They want this to go to the Supreme Court, and they imagine that it will overturn Roe versus Wade. And sadly, they may be right. And have you heard in the last 3 days any Democratic elected officials pipe up and criticize the Supreme Court for failing to take up the Arkansas case? I haven't. Interesting numbers released from the Department of Homeland Security about arrests at the southern border. Last year, they dropped precipitously, but this year, they are back up to almost standard levels. In March and again in April, arrests near the border exceeded 50,000. Those are the highest monthly totals since Trump took office, and they parallel what was happening under Obama. We're on track to see as many as 400,000 border arrests this year. And this really pisses Trump off and makes him stomp his feet and yell at Kirsten, what's her name, the Homeland Security director of the moment. And, of course, it makes him want to build a wall. Real bad. Even though we all know that's ludicrous, he thinks it will stop people. And it's interesting that the zero-tolerance policy announced a month ago, the brazen and public effort to separate families who approach the border, doesn't seem to have slowed the traffic headed northward. Trump has been complaining that a recent study showed that 90% of media coverage of him is negative. And in an interesting piece in the Washington Post today, a columnist quotes Tim Miller, who worked on Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign. And Miller argues that the media actually is under-reporting the negatives of Donald Trump. He says a mixture of fundamental human nature, incentives in journalism that reward recency, access, and balance, this pressures reporters into treating Trump with far more leniency than he deserves. I think that's an important argument. California's primary is shaping up for this coming Tuesday. We expect Gavin Newsom to be the Democratic nominee for governor, and he will coast to election in the fall. Whether or not the top two primary produces a Republican opponent, it's a long shot for the second-place Democrat, former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, to make the cutoff into the top two runoff. And in the Senate race, Dianne Feinstein is untouched by a series of challengers, including Kevin DeLeon, who is a state senator and the majority leader of the Senate here in California. I will be voting for the real progressive in the Senate race, Pat Harris, and I'm going to vote for the real progressive in the gubernatorial race, too. That is Delaine Easton. But as people go to vote for members of Congress, we are seeing a couple of trends that I've commented on before playing out here in California. Self-funding Democratic challengers, including those who were Republicans just 6 months or a year ago, are dominating three races in Southern California where Democrats are hoping to roust Republicans. And in these races, the rich Democrats who've been recruited have kicked in an amazing amount of money, $16 million out of the total 23 that has been raised in these races so far. It's about two-thirds of the money. And it's interesting because David Dayan at The Intercept points out that people who fund their own races only win about 12% of the time. When the uber wealthy go out in 2016, 12.5% were successful. And here in California, we've seen people try to buy mostly the governorship, like Meg Whitman, Al Checky, Steve Forbes, and they all failed. And so why the Democrats have bet on these people and on the spooks and soldiers that Patrick Martin analyzed in his look at the challengers in the Democratic primaries this year. And I'll mention that Patrick Martin's work has been published in a booklet called The CIA Democrats, and they mailed me a copy. You can probably find out how to get one of your own at WSWS.org. That is the World Socialist website. And I'm planning to have Patrick Martin return to the podcast sometime in June to comment on the outcome of many of these primary races. And finally today, The Intercept has a misleading article under the byline of Sam Biddle. Sam got a hold of a phishing email that was used to purportedly break into or attempt to break into voting systems in North Carolina. And they say that the NSA believed that this was Russian military intelligence trying to hack into the voting infrastructure of the United States. Only they don't prove any of that. They show us a screenshot of this phishing email that was phonied up to look like it came from the company that manages the electronic voting systems, VR Elections. But they don't report of a single case where somebody fell for the phishing bait and enabled the hackers to get in and either monitor or ultimately try to manipulate the outcome. And they quote one of the people from VR Systems, COO Ben Martin, "When a customer alerted us to an obviously fraudulent email purporting to come from VR Systems, we immediately notified our customers and advised them not to click on the attachment. Most election officials have security systems in place that would have flagged the email before it even reached the intended recipient. After we notified our customers, most told us that their spam filter caught the email or that they never received it. We are only aware of a small number of our customers who actually received the email, and of those, none of them notified us that they clicked on the attachment or were compromised as a result." How many people do you know who buy into the urban myth that Russian hacking included getting into voting systems last year? They may have attempted it, although we never know who the real authors are of hacking attempts. But this is another case of media malpractice, in my humble opinion. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's free. You're free to share it far and wide. And we post it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.